Thank you very much for the introduction. And in case some of you feel like they're having a deja vu, yes, this is my second talk, but actually I'm only replacing Wissam Shemisani, who was supposed to give this talk originally, but unfortunately could not attend this conference in person in the end. And since I'm the only one else who's attending this conference, the burden was transferred onto me. All right, so yes, I'm talking about this project together with Wissam, Charles Tsao, and Zoltan from Wigner Research Center in Hungary. And our project is Overlapping Qubits from Monosymmetric Maps and Dissidata Tensor Networks. There was an earlier title we had that was a bit longer. This is already the shorter version. All right, so as we talk about holography and quantum information and fundamental physics, we often encounter a bunch of maps between Hilbert spaces. And what these maps really do is they take us from one Hilbert space, which is sort of the apparent Hilbert space that we have in our system, and it maps us to another Hilbert space, which I call HM and HN. The other Hilbert space is somehow supposed to be a fundamental Hilbert space, or Hilbert space, in which somehow we can learn about other aspects of our original system. And in the quantum information aspect of all of this, a very useful question to ask about these maps is, a very simple question to ask also, is whether this map V is isometric or not. So for example, if we consider just semi-classical ADS CFT, we talk about holographic codes, we often look at a semi-classical ADS bulk, so some degrees of freedom in the bulk around the semi-classical background, which is make up our Hilbert space HM, and we map them to a boundary conformal field theory, and of course, because we only choose a logical subspace of the bulk, the Hilbert space HN is usually significantly larger than the Hilbert space HM. And initially we thought that this map is isometric, so it's an exact isometry, but more recently we realized actually that it's not 100% isometric, there's some small corrections to this, and so the question of whether this map is isometric or not really teaches us a lot about how the code aspect of ADS CFT behaves. Another recent example where we suspect to find an exact isometry is the question of how the Hilbert space of de Sitter spacetime looks like, which was recently studied in this paper by Kotler and Strominger, where they asked the question of what happens if you look at a de Sitter spacetime, so an evolving universe, some time t, and some later time t prime. And naively, we would have thought that in quantum field theory, everything should just evolve unitarily, but they said that if you have some reasonable cutoffs of your theory, really what you should see is an isometric map V. In this case, it's an exact isometry because the Hilbert space just keeps growing, and from causality, everything that happens at one time t evolves to some determined state at t prime. Another more recently studied case by this paper, which considered non-isometric codes, we also learned that there are certain maps that map the black hole interior to an effective horizon theory, and that after the page time, such maps should also be non-isometric. So somehow, the degrees of freedom that describe the black hole interior, HM, end up after the page time to be seemingly much larger than the Hilbert space that we have available for a holographic description, because essentially Hawking radiation creates more and more pairs on the interior. And the authors of this paper argued that really if you just naively continue the structure of this map, it just becomes non-isometric, and then we end up with an entanglement entropy that keeps going down after the page time, so we recover the page curve just from constructing these non-isometric maps. Here's an example where we have a very heavily non-isometric map because this Hilbert space ends up being much smaller than the other. And so the topic of this talk is to ask, I think, a slightly broader question related to quantum gravity. Now, we know that quantum gravity somehow serves as a truncation of semi-classical gravity. So if we have a semi-classical background, if we put a Hilbert space on top of it, then that Hilbert space looks nice and fine at low energies. But we know that if we really believe in quantum gravity, that this Hilbert space should somehow change as we go to high energies and if we explore our entire seemingly Hilbert space. And so the question that we are really interested in is whether we can generally describe the map from this apparent semi-classical Hilbert space to the true quantum gravity Hilbert space by a map that is, well, either isometric or non-isometric. And the main argument of this talk, I can already tell you, will be that if we assume that these maps are generally non-isometric, we can actually reproduce a lot of what we expect to find from quantum gravity corrections. Okay, so let me go back to the basics and just talk about what I mean by isometric and non-isometric. Well, the thing most trivial insight here is that if you have a map from a Hilbert space HM to a Hilbert space HN, in order for this map to even potentially be isometric, of course, the Hilbert space HN needs to be at least as big as the Hilbert space HM. A consequence of that is that once you have a map where the Hilbert space is the same size or larger, you can use it to define an exact quantum code, which means that both the preparation of a logical state and its recovery into the physical state can be performed by an exact unitary circuit. So there's no loss of information as you go from the physical to the logical Hilbert space. Now, of course, if you have a non-isometric map, in particular one where the Hilbert space Hn is smaller than Hm, then you cannot preserve information. As you encode and decode, you lose some information. And one way of describing this is by looking at this map V dagger V, which is now no longer an identity, so it's no longer an isometry. And this map you can think of, in most cases, as a projector onto a preserved subspace of your larger Hilbert space. And now the question, as I already alluded to earlier, is whether this Hilbert space truncation that we find in quantum gravity can be described by some sort of non-isometric projection. Okay, so how do we answer this question? Well, let's first understand what really happens if we have a projection by such a non-isometric map. And one way of doing this is with a tool of quantum information that is known as overlapping qubits. So what is the question here? So the question is, you take a Hilbert space, a large Hilbert space, and you try to compress it into a Hilbert space of smaller size, and you want to figure out what happens to the operators of your Hilbert space. So you have here, for example, your x and z, Pauli is acting on each exact Hilbert space and your large Hilbert space, on your exact operators, exact qubits, and you somehow compress them down into the Hilbert space Hn. What do we do? Well, we define these projected Pauli operators, which are just the original Pauli operators acted on by this non-isometric map. And generally, of course, what happens now is that the algebra that these operators observe obey after the projection is now different from the original one. In particular, if you look at commutators, for example, at for example, X Paulis at different sites after this projection, they will no longer exactly commute, and you will generally find some epsilon difference from the exact Hilbert space result. And now, generally, you might think that if you do such a compression of your Hilbert space, you generally completely mess up these commutators and you just kind of do quantum physics really anymore. But there was a very interesting result a few years ago by Chao et al., this paper where they found out that if you just look at these commutators, just look at the corrections that you get to them by such an overlap, it is in fact possible to compress the Hilbert space size exponentially by keeping this correction constant. So you can really do like a vast reduction of your Hilbert space and still sort of preserve the approximate locality of your commutators. Of course, there are other ways that you might figure out that your Hilbert space is not as big as it seems, but if you just look at this operator commutator structure, then it's surprisingly resilient. So the question from this result is, well, do we have any physical examples that we could apply this to? Do we have any physical system where the Hilbert space seems to grow much, much too far than from what we expect on just physical grounds? And one example that I want to talk to you about is that example of De Sitter spacetime that I already mentioned in the beginning, which, of course, is a spacetime solution, a general relativity solution to a universe with pure positive cosmological constants, so a universe that's sort of the asymptotic version of our own universe at large time, where we just have inflation, essentially. So now here I have a picture of the embedding of De Sitter in higher coordinates and higher Minkowski coordinates. And here on the right-hand side is essentially the Penrose diagram of the space-time in conformal coordinates. So you have these red time-like slices, and here you have these blue space-like ones. And so, yeah, as you know, this is an expanding universe. And something you know if you read some of Lenny Susskind's recent papers is that you can divide De Sitter into what he calls a pod and an antipode at t equal to zero, so two antipodal observers. And these two observers have a static patch, which is sort of the region they're causally connected to. And this region really is just some constant volume in De Sitter, as you can see in this embedding coordinates. And in between these two regions, as time increases, there's a very, very rapidly expanding exterior region. And so this is really the reason why somehow this Hilbert space seems to grow so quickly, even though each observer seems to have only access to a finite volume. Okay, so now how do we build maps? Well, the continuum is hard, so we do what we always do. We try to discretize it and then play around with some toy model. And a very convenient toy model for De Sitter is given by the MERA tensor network. Now, MERA has been proposed many, many times as a description of the sitter, description of the sitter. Initially, it was also proposed as a version of anti-de Sitter spacetime, which it also kind of does, but there are some restrictions. In any case, Mera exactly reproduces the causal structure of de Sitter. For example, if you take the t larger than zero part of the Penrose diagram, you can exactly reproduce the causal structure by the tensor network, basically resulting from the properties that we have on the tensors themselves. So we have these unitaries U, and these isometries I, and if you look at how the causal structure behaves, you exactly get this static patch behavior in the discrete setting. And now, of course, every tensor here is basically takes up a volume of the size of a Hubble volume, so somehow the observable universe. So you should think of this as an extremely coarse-grained version of de Sitter. But yeah, I mean, with the toy models, we have to lose some information. So now this Mera construction gives us discrete degrees of freedom. We can very easily define maps between well, essentially just sets of legs in our tensor network. And there's two very straightforward maps that we can define from this. And I'll call this a global and a local map. And both of them are non-isometric in nature. Let's start with a global one. This one's very simple. We just take our time slice at some time t, and we relate the Hilbert space of this time slice to the Hilbert space at some initial time t equal to zero. And so we basically say that the Hilbert space of this model of such a universe is just constant. We fix it at the beginning. And if we want to evaluate operators up here, we just map them down to this initial Hilbert space. Now remember, as I said again, this is a model of this is extremely coarse-grained. So of course, each tensor basically describes a vast amount of space-time. But yeah, you can make this assumption. And what you find from this model is that, well, as I said, you can preserve this overlap up to some exponential increase in size. But here, the Hilbert space stays constant. So what happens is, as this universe keeps evolving and evolving and evolving, at some point, you sort of hit the end of your compressibility, and you start getting non-trivial overlaps of your commutators. And so basically, locality breaks down after a certain time. And this time, in terms of the Hubble time, is of the order of the Sitter entropy in this model. So for our universe, it would be something to like 10 to the 120, a fairly large number. And curiously, this result is actually consistent with models of slow roll inflation, where you find a very similar relationship between the time of inflation and the de Sitter entropy. OK, that's a global map. There's another construction that you can very easily come up with. Well, you don't need to use the entire global structure of this tensor network, which is a local map. So now we look at local subregions on time slices that I call R. And a very natural reason to associate it in the bulk to this subregion R is the horizon of its past domain of dependence. And this is basically, if you're familiar with the older ADS Mera models, the RT surface of this region. So in the interpretation where this is the ADS boundary, this would be the RT surface. This would be the entanglement wedge. And here again, we can do a compression from the Hilbert space on R to the Hilbert space on HR. And so it's a compression where the Hilbert space becomes exponentially smaller. And same as in the ADS Mera model, this size of HR essentially bounds the entanglement of this subregion. OK, so what do we really learn from this, from these models? Is there anything we can say about the physics? Well, something that we would want to have preserved by these models, of course, is some notion of approximate locality. So we wouldn't just want our commutators to be to have some easily measurable constant value. But ideally, what we want them to do is to decay quickly with distance so we don't get any weird non-local cosmological effects. And so we expect that if we look at the commutator between two operators on site J and K, they decay farther quickly. So if we just have some half-random projection of our initial Hilbert space, which is like the simplest thing you can think about, then clearly this doesn't work. You just get commutators that are slightly different on the diagonals and on the off-diagonals. But on the off-diagonals, they're all the same, so there's no decay. So presumably, if the universe is stingy with its qubits and compresses them in this way, then you really would detect this quite easily. But fortunately, in these Mera models, both in the global and local ones, we find that you exactly get this decay of commutator corrections. So if you look at large distances, you approximately get commutators that you would have expected from the exact Hilbert space. And in fact, for the local model, because the Hilbert space sort of is a bit bigger in relationship to it, we seem to find even a faster decay of these commutators, so some stronger locality. And so you might ask which tensors we actually use in this model. So we did a very simple setting for the mirror, which is that of the easing model, where each tensor is chosen to represent some state here on the future infinity slice that represents the critical easing ground state. Now you might say this is like a special model, it's only because we pick these particular tensors that we get this result. But for example, you can also just choose completely locally random tensors in this network. And then you find basically the same result, that you get a similar decay of correlations. So it's really the causal structure of a mirror, and as a result, the causal structure of the sitter that should preserve this approximate commutator locality if you assume that there's such a compression going on. OK, you can also relate this to energies. So I think this is maybe a more more natural language for physicists. So if we think about a unitary that maps us from the original Hilbert space to the eigenspace of some Hamiltonian, for example, the easing model in this simple toy example, we project out all of the high energy states. How does that affect non-locality? What do we learn about overlapping qubits there? And what we find is that such a picture and such a setting, you very neatly get the same behavior as before, that the commutator corrections decay very quickly. So this is, of course, again, just a toy model of the toy model. But in fact, we can find the same behavior in this mirror model as well on a more slightly more rigorous level. Oh, sorry, let me add a small comment here that these corrections at high energy and small distance are, of course, also expected from what's known as gravitational dressing, where we expect that at small distances and high energies, we get some breakdown of non-locality. That's expected. But yeah, in the global and local mirror, we basically find the same behavior, in that if you look at eigenstates of some Hamiltonian, for example, again, the easing model, because it's simple, if we look at how this projector, V dagger V, preserves each of these eigenstates, we find that the low-energy eigenstates are preserved. So if you write down an effective theory on your smaller Hilbert space, then you can sort of simulate, if you want, the low-energy physics very well. And the high-energy states have a much lower fidelity. But there's one very interesting difference between the global and the local model. The global one, as you might have expected from RG arguments, really sharply truncates the Hilbert space after the first 2 to the n energy eigenstates. And after that, basically, you lose all the information about high-energy eigenstates, whereas in the local model, this decay is somehow very, very smooth. So even though you lose information about high-energy physics, it's still approximately preserved. So this might potentially mean that you can use this model as a sort of simulation ansatz for describing low-energy CFT physics. OK, so I've talked about effective theories that we get from this compression. And these are mapped to some fundamental theory. Now, if you could just think about this in terms of a Hamiltonian, you can also find a very striking difference between this global and local mirror model. In particular, if you lose the global mirror truncation, you do what people who have worked with mirror for years already know, which is that you really just take your Hamiltonian, you truncate it, you coarse-grain it, so to speak, and you get a new Hamiltonian, which is basically the old theory, but coarse-grained to some lower energies or larger scales. And so you completely preserve the locality structure. You don't really get a new theory. You just apply an RG flow. But this local mirror model, with this horizon cutoff, really maps us from a local theory to a very different non-local theory. So here's an example of the causal structure that you get after this map. And so you can see that if you have, for example, a term in your Hamiltonian that only acts on nearest neighbors, and applying this map will end up producing a Hamiltonian in your fundamental theory on your projected subspace, which is extremely non-local. And this is quite interesting because, as some of you may know, Lenny recently proposed that if we think about holography in de Sitter spacetime, we should think of a fundamental theory sort of living on the horizon of, well, in this case, a static patch, this is sort of the inverse exterior region, so to speak. And he argued that this dual theory should be an extremely non-local theory that he identified as being large QSYK. So somehow we also get some non-local theories living on horizons. I'm not sure there's a deep connection there. It's just an interesting remark. OK, and I think I'm almost running out of time. So let me wrap up and sort of go back to the big picture of this construction. So our argument is that we can learn something about quantum gravity by thinking about overlapping qubit algebras. And really what this does is it relates to very old problems. And the first problem is that of counting the degrees of freedom of Hilbert spaces once you include gravity, as gravity sort of messes up your naive semi-classical counting. And the second problem that now seems deeply related to the first in this construction is a problem of Hilbert space dimension verification, which is also a problem in people have studied for years in quantum information, where the question is you're giving Hilbert space, you're given operators on it, you're given access to Hilbert space via operators with which you can act, and you try to figure out how big your Hilbert space is just by acting with these operators and measuring stuff. And so now these problems are deeply related because if we have overlapping qubits, then the failure of verifying the dimension of your Hilbert space is exactly the failure of figuring out the size of your Hilbert space once you go into the quantum gravity regime. Okay, and this approach clearly raises lots of questions. It's very speculative. So one question is whether there's sort of general principle behind this, whether we can also always describe quantum gravity by just mapping to quantum mechanics in some different perhaps smaller Hilbert space. I mean, this is something that seems to work very well in ADS-CFT, but maybe there's a general physical principle behind all of this. Another question I think that we've also wondered a lot about in this community is, what about flat space-time? And then what I already related to is, what I already mentioned before, is this question of static patch holography that Eleni Saskin and others have recently been studying, and there's a question of whether there's anything we can learn about this by looking at through the lens of overlapping qubits. And finally, a question for the tensor network people, whether these local MERA models can be used as some sort of projection onto an effective field theory or effective theory of low-energy CFTs that we can somehow use to, for example, simulate low-energy physics in these models. Okay, and with that, I think I've exactly used up my time. So let me finish in the Zwinglian tradition with a Midjourney picture showing us expanding space-time built from overlapping qubits. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for the talk, Alex. I think one concern that I have is that when I say like semi-classical gravity is a good approximation, I think I usually mean more than just that the commutator, it's good at predicting commutators of operators.
Yes.
I also mean it's good at, say, like predicting the outcome of simple measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as you alluded to, the overlapping qubits construction can't do that. Right, because you can just do like a linear measurement, and then you get a radically different outcome.
Exactly. So this is something that already the people who wrote this original overlapping qubit paper realized. There's this, I think, NIAC's information retrieval bound. Basically, if you just try to store information in your Hilbert space, you can very quickly realize that the size of it is limited. But the nice thing about the sitter setup is actually that even though you have this very, very large Hilbert space, you really, as an observer, can't apply that many operators to it, because you, as an observer, you are limited to a static patch, which means that you can only try to store information into a very limited part of your apparent Hilbert space. So there are some physical restrictions that might save us in this case. But I agree. For example, if you try to just naively apply this overlapping qubit setting to the thing that you were working on, or like black holes, for example, then you get some semi-contradictions.
Just to follow up on that, can you go to the slide where you have the where you show the commutator? I think it's slide 3 or something, fairly early.
This one?
No, all the way back.
All the way back.
Almost all the way back. Where you conjugate that one? Yeah.
Ah.
Okay. So like a question we could ask. So you have these. I'm not sure what we should call them. Let's call them compressed polys. This XP and ZP. Okay. A question we could ask is, in the regime where there are exponentially fewer qubits, like you said, if I compute the matrix elements of these compressed polys in states which are compressed by V,
mm-hmm.
are the matrix elements close to the uncompressed matrix elements? And I'm pretty sure the answer is no.
The matrix elements close. The overlap between the eigenstates.
Well, no, just take a state psi.
Yes.
And act on it with V. So let's call that psi p. That's the compressed state.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can ask, if we compute the matrix elements of the compressed operators in the compressed states, is it close to the uncompressed operators in the uncompressed states?
I feel like this is sort of a Hilbert space version of this Johnson-Lindenstrauss idea, right? That you take a bunch of vectors in R to the n, and you try to project it down to a much smaller space R to the power of m. And in that case, I think you can also show that the overlaps just between the states are also quite low.
That's true. So, I know about that. But, yes. But I'm asking about the matrix elements of the operators, because if we don't...
Oh, you mean the expectation values of these operators?
Yes, the expectation
states.
Values
yes.
in the compressed states.
So, yeah. So the thing that you need for this to work is something that is called the approximate homomorphism property. So basically what you want is that the operators acting on your projected Hilbert space are approximately equivalent to the projected operators acting on your projected Hilbert space.
Yes.
So that's an assumption you have to make.
Yeah, and it's. I think it's not true. I mean, I think Chris has a proof that it can't be done in this regime where it's exponentially fewer.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what Hilbert space you sort of
the compressed
allow. But and there can also be a state dependence there. You can have approximate homomorphism for some.
Yeah, of course, if it's state dependent, that's different. But this map here is not state dependent. This is a linear map. This compression of the operators.
Exactly. I mean, and one of the nice things about this overlapping qubit approach is that you try not to think about the states at all. You just try to think about the operators themselves.
Yeah, but the states are important too, right? I mean, okay, why?
Yeah, I agree with
that. I don't know what the operators mean if you don't preserve the matrix elements.
Yeah. I agree there's some caveats there, but maybe we can talk about this later.
Just as a follow, I think maybe I'm confused about this discussion because I would have said the point that Daniel just raised is a feature, not a bug. I mean, isn't the point that this left Hilbert space, the effective field theory Hilbert space, most of the states in there are garbage.
Yes.
And so you know, this map does not preserve their inner product because they were not good states to begin with.
Exactly.
So it's actually good that it's not preserving matrix elements, except for a very small number of very special states.
Yes.
Is that right? Or have I misunderstood the logic here?
But no, but I think the idea is that in this large Hilbert space, you think you have states which exist in your Hilbert space, but really they don't. For example, if you have states where you have a very high energy density, you would actually form a black hole, and there would be nothing you could do with your operators anymore. So you want to lose part of your Hilbert space, right? You want to describe, you want to somehow project down to a subset of these apparent states that somehow define your true quantum gravity Hilbert space. I mean, the difference, I think, between this approach and the one that you had in the question of black hole interiors is for black hole interiors, the physical constraint really is the one of complexity. You somehow want high complexity states to be non-physical because, well, you can't really access them anyways if you fall into a black hole, well, presumably. But in this case, somehow the constraint that we have, or this constraint that we find, is the one at high energy, so high energy densities. So I'm not entirely sure how these two constraints are related. Somehow there seem to be some differences in the way this map V works in your proposal, where you sort of don't want to have a V dagger map, or the inverse map of V is not really V dagger, but something more complicated. But yeah, there might be some relationship between these two constraints. But in De Sitter, I think the more convenient truncation to think about is an energy truncation.
People in the chat agree with me.
You mentioned this feature that the mirror map that you construct preserves the low energy subspace and like it doesn't preserve the high energy states well. So does that follow from some general feature of mirror?
Yes, exactly. So this global mirror is very easy to see because we often think of mirror as an RG flow, right? Like it takes us from some coarse-grained version of a CFT state to a fine-grained one. And so in that sense, we can think of the operators acting on one slice as the operators acting on one effective energy truncated theory. So if we just take a cutoff somewhere here at some length scale, then we effectively truncate the corresponding energy. In the local mirror, it's a bit tricky to see. Somehow in that case, you take, you sort of lose all the Hilbert space of operators that you would have outside of here that you could act on. And you can, you lose all the actions that you have in here. So you can convince yourself that somehow the operators that you would act on here would only change the state in this region by in the high energy sector, because they somehow only act on low distance physics.
Okay, let's thank Alex.